Hi, I'm Diana Yokley. I'm a peaceful parenting coach and mom of three, and I'm delighted to give you the latest science-backed research on child development, parenting, and to support you in showing up as the parent that you want to be. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. I'm here today with Lisa Bayless. Welcome, Lisa. I'm so glad to have you here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always a pleasure to come and speak. I'm happy to be here too.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Lisa is the author of Self-Compassion for Educators and also is an expert in overall self-compassion and works for the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion as well. So I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about, for my parenting audience, a little bit about what self-compassion is, what's the research say about self-compassion, and why should parents care about being more self-compassionate? How does that support them in parenting?
Yeah, I mean, so many questions there. I'll start maybe with you know, what is self-compassion? The general definition of self-compassion is can I treat myself perhaps the same way I would treat a dear friend or somebody that I love? Or, you know, can I meet myself with the same kind of care, tenderness, kindness that I would treat my kids with? And truly, that was one of, I'm also a parent, so I now have a 12 and a almost 14-year-old. And you know, for me, this practice of self-compassion started when I realized my daughter, when she was six, started having some critical thoughts. Like, we're very quick as humans to listen to the critical voices, the harsh, the judgment, those things that are negative in our thinking patterns. And I heard her saying it was so easy for me to wrap her up and to be like, well, what, like, actually, here's what I'm hearing, and here's how I love you, and this is why you're wonderful. And my tone was caring and loving, and it was so easy to just wrap her up in love. And then I would go leave her, and I would hear the same judgmental tones I was talking to myself, you know, things like, you're not good enough, you're such a terrible parent, why can't you get your kids to do this, what's wrong with you? And how quickly the judgments came and the expectations of perfection. And you know, self-compassion is sort of the antidote to that perfectionist expectation. So it's really gives us permission to be human. And I learned early on when I started this practice, one of the things that I always try and say to myself is, would you say what you're saying to your children? Like, would I say what I'm saying to myself to my daughter? Would I want her to have that voice in her head? And always the answer was usually, no, I don't want her talking to her. I would never say that to her. I would never say it to anyone else. And so self-compassion is a wonderful invitation to start getting aware of how we're meeting ourselves when things go wrong, when things are hard, when we're just not getting it, when we're failing, when we're feeling inadequate. And instead of turning to that judging critical thought, it's meeting ourselves with a bit of care and kindness instead. That's sort of the, what is compassion? What is self-compassion by definition is, you know, I notice the suffering that exists and I have a desire, there's an action part of it to alleviate it. There's actually three parts of self-compassion. The first is mindfulness. It's the awareness that there's suffering in the world and sort of like there's some, when someone else is suffering, if my son is hurting, right? I notice that his things are going on. Self-compassion is this one too, right? I notice when I'm stressed, I'm overwhelmed. So that's the first piece when practicing. The second is this concept of common humanity. Like, yeah, other people feel that way too, right? When my son falls and trips and skins his knee when he was little, you know, it wasn't an overreact. It's like kids do that, right? This is what happens. When I fall over and I feel like a fool, it's like, well, I'm a human. Like, things happen, right? There's an invitation that we're not so isolated in our suffering.
And that our experience isn't so like abnormal. Like, why is this always happening just to me?
Yeah. And as a parent, that's such a quick thing to jump into, or my kids are this way, or I'm the only parent who can't get their kids out the door in the morning, or like, why can't my kids eat vegetables, right? Like these things. And actually, I mean, this is why parent groups are such a lovely place. And from when they're little infant babies and you have no idea what you're doing until they're in their teens and you're like, oh yeah, me too, right? Like, my kids too, or that's how I feel too. I'm not alone. It's a real lovely place to sit in connection. Yeah. So when we're practicing self-compassion, there's that I'm aware of it. I'm reminded I'm not alone. And then we add that third piece, which is we use the language loving kindness, but it's really just that, can I treat myself the same way I would treat other people? Can I, you know, how I would respond to my son if he had fallen, I would wrap him up with love and care and hold him and tell him he's going to be okay. And we deserve the same sort of response as parents, right? When we feel like we're not doing a very good job, we need to wrap ourselves up and say, we're doing the best that we can. It's just a difficult moment. And so,
And for those individuals that might, I was going to say, go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I was going to say, for those individuals that might feel like, oh, well, you know, that seems like a little bit like you're self-pampering or something. I almost think of it as like this moral obligation to other people, because it doesn't, and I don't know if you know specifically, but I've read that some research says that people that are actually more self-compassionate are actually able to support others. Like they're actually more helpful to other people in society, in their community. So it's like being self-compassionate is like, that's how you actually can help other people even more than you would if you weren't self-compassionate. So if you're not going to do it for yourself, do it for the other person. Like, do you care enough about them? Even if you don't want to start with caring enough about yourself almost.
Well, and we know that one begets another. The more we are compassionate in the world, we have the capacity to care for ourselves. And actually, in fact, we can continue to care outwardly, but get exhausted. In fact, you know, if we don't include ourselves in the circle of compassion, we just won't have enough capacity. You know, like this is where that concept of burnout comes, or compassion fatigue. I had the privilege once of learning from who I think is one of, you know, an incredible researcher and doctor, Dr. Gabor Mate. And I remember he's done a lot of work in trauma and addictions. And I was in a room with, you know, 300 other caregivers, so parents, doctors, teachers, counselors, therapists, social workers. And he looked at all of us and he said, you know, compassion fatigue doesn't actually exist. And you could feel this whole room go like, are you kidding me? Like all I do in the world is give to other people. And that's what compassion often feels like. Feels like we're giving a lot, but compassion is it's a positive emotion. When we do it in a positive way, we actually get a positive response. It's part of our brain that elicits, you know, dopamine and oxytocin, the part of our brain that feels good. And the reason we feel fatigued by it is we're not actually staying in a compassion. We're giving in a non-loving way. And the only way, and this is one of those moments where he sort of mic dropped for me, he said, you don't have compassion fatigue. You have self-compassion fatigue, actually, is that in those times, what you're not doing is you're not really true replenishing, loving yourself up. You know, it's that metaphor of putting your own oxygen mask on. The only way we can show up for everybody else, as parents, as teachers, it's like any person who considers themselves a caregiver, and in our world, we're all caregivers in some capacity. So if we're going to continue to show up and care for the world, for our families, for our kids, for our partners, for the work that we do, we have to include ourselves in that circle. And we have to model it for our kids. We're in a global crisis of mental health with children right now. And the only way we're going to see their mental health increase is if, as adults, we model what it looks like to meet the challenging situations with compassion, with love, with kindness, with space for ourselves, and stop projecting, you know, how hard life is, because the world will do that already. We live in a time where the world is challenging. So as parents, the more so than ever, the practice of self-compassion is foundational for us as the parents, as the people, so that our children can also learn it, and that we're not continuing another generation that feels that perfectionism is the only way, that doesn't know how to manage challenging situations that come up. Because the only thing we can guarantee in our world is that suffering will occur. Like, it's part of being human. So we have to learn how to meet it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you highlighted kind of the mental health challenges that children, especially teens, are facing. And I think often parents will look for resources. You know, they realize their kid maybe has anxiety or some depression, and they try to seek out resources for their child. They get anxious. And then they become hypervigilant about what is going on. Oh no, self-blame, self-criticism. How could I have let this develop? How come I didn't see it sooner? And then they try to kind of resource their child with these supports. Meanwhile, like you said, kind of missing the most important message, which is your child is around you probably more so than that other mental health care provider, right? And so your nervous system is going to be the one that resources them more than anyone else's, even 1 hour, you know, 1 hour therapy a week, versus you being with them like 10 hours a day. And so mammals learn from other mammals by observation, right? It's very primitive. It's very actually simple. Mm-hmm. While it's hard for us to prioritize ourselves, the equation is very simple into how you can help influence your child as much as possible, obviously.
Totally. Yeah. And the thing here that's also just important to acknowledge, like when our babies suffer, it breaks us, right? Yes. Like as parents, when whether it's your child falls down and scrapes their knee, or they're anxious or depressed or suffering, heartbroken, like when our babies, when we have this attachment to our own babies, like when my kids are hurting, there is nothing in the world that I wouldn't want to do to fix it for them, right, because right. My heart hurts too. This is empathic resonating, right? Like I'm feeling with my kids, and we feel most with our own children. So because they're hurting, we hurt too. So we want to fix them so that we can fix our own hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the most important things that we need to realize as parents is, one, it's okay for our kids to suffer because it's part of learning resilience. And two, when they're hurting, and you feel that hurt, it's your job at that moment to meet yourself and your own hurt. This is our job as adults at that time, is to tend to our own trauma, hurt, suffering, so we can be present with them, so that we're not negating their own hurt. You know, we're not trying to push their hurt away, because when we do that to sort of help ourselves in those moments, it doesn't allow them to go through their own full experience of being human. And this is where compassion for ourselves as adults, as parents, is such an important piece to practice, so that when our babies hurt, when they're in tears, when they're suffering, we can sit with them and say, like, yeah, it's hard. I get it. I feel it too. I know what you're going through, or, you know, like this is just a time, and I feel when you hurt, I hurt, and that's okay. We're allowed to be, you know, like it's okay to hurt right now. You know, you're not the only one. Other people would feel just like you. Like this reminder for our kids. I remember I worked for years as a school counselor, and I have this vivid memory early in my career sitting down with a young man.
Excuse me.
A young man when he was, 17 or 18, and he came into my office, and he's like, this is what I'm, and he was telling me what he was going through. I remember sitting and saying, you know, everybody in the school is going through what you're going through right now. And he was just shocked. He's like, no, I'm the only one who comes in here. And I was like, actually, I have a rotating, you know, door of kids that come in here and suffering. It's hard. And I said, you know, you think you're not good enough to be a part of this school community, and you think that you're lonely right now, and you think nobody wants to be your friend. But I can tell you that every single kid that comes in my door feels the same way. And it's just because you don't know each other. And, and you see this light bulb moment of like, really, I'm not the only one who feels these feelings. And so, you know, giving our kids, and as early as when they're very, very young to when they're in their teenagers, that space to recognize that it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to feel hurt. And then to give them that reminder that, and they can meet that with care, because we've modeled it as parents. We're sitting with them. We're present with them. It's such a gift. It's truly the greatest gift we can give our kids, is to not get so caught up in our own emotions that they can't be fully present with theirs.
My hope is that the information that you receive on this podcast is supportive of your parenting. And if you find this information relevant, please gift this resource to other parents by sharing it with a friend, leaving a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts so that other parents can see this rated higher and can also benefit from this knowledge. And also want to remind you that this podcast is listener sponsored and is brought to you free of ads. That means that I bring you this information and the latest neuroscience on parenting and child development that's not sponsored by anyone but you. And if you'd like to support us staying on air, please consider upgrading to a paid Substack subscription for only 16 cents a day.
With the paid subscription, you also receive free access to my amazing resource, which is a members-only monthly masterclass with Q&A. And this often involves other parenting experts that I've brought to the discussion at a fraction of the regular price for the public. And for my most loyal listeners on Substack and on this podcast, if you'd like to become a founding member with a $300 annual fee, you will receive a complimentary 1-hour private coaching session with me to support you in your parenting and put the delight back into raising your child. To learn more, please go to delightinparenting.substack.com.
Right, because the science of emotions is that they live in the body, and to be able to process them, you have to go through them. You have to like metabolize them. You got to eat them up so that they can go through, and then they kind of come out, right? So they kind of process. But if, like you said, like if the parent is anxious about the child being anxious, they are helping the child suppress these emotions, and they're suppressing it, which means they're just actually staying there longer. Can you talk a little bit about like how, because I think sometimes people talk about like children aren't as resilient as they used to be because they're kind of being sheltered from whatever. Like, I don't know if you have like a framework for what people are saying about like how children are more fragile, resulting in more this whole process of not letting them feel their feelings. What do parents kind of generally do?
Well, I think we're at a time in our society too where kids have access to more of where the pain is in the world, and more of the fear, and more of what's harsh in the world. And it's not actually always being discussed and shared and moved through. And then there's not necessarily a space for peace and safety. And like, I think about when I was a child and my parents would put the news on, and we would watch the news in the world, and we would see the things that were going on at, you know, the 5 o'clock news. And then we would talk about like what was going on in the world, and then we would turn it off, and then that was it. It was over, and then we could go outside and play, or we could do things. But we have a generation that has access to stress 24 hours a day because they're in front of their screens, and there's nobody processing with them. There's nobody turning this off, and we're also, like you said too, we're wrapping these kids up so that they're not experience things. So not only are we not helping them process the hard things in the world, we're also not letting them go through challenging situations, right? We're keeping them safe. They're not going out because we're all afraid of the world. They're not having to push themselves a little bit to see if they can be successful, like to walk around the block by themselves, or to, you know, go down the street and catch the bus, because we're walking with them because we're afraid. So there's a level of fear in our world because of all of the things that we see that are going wrong, that we then protect and keep our kids safer for longer, which then doesn't give them the opportunity to, I mean, resilience means you fall down and you get up, right? We have to, when our kids are crawling, we let them fall over so that they can learn to get back up, right? This is part of being a parent. We see them fall over and we go, oops, you're okay, try again. And with this like encouragement, and then they become a little older and we go, ooh, you can't do that because it's not safe. And then they think that the world is unsafe. And
that they can't do it, that they can't handle it.
And they can't do it, and they can't handle it. And then when they can't handle it, we increase anxiety because there's fear. And so the practice in all of this is recognizing that, yes, the world is scary. Yes, there are many things. And also the world is beautiful. There are many people that are safe. There are places that we can do. And obviously I'm saying this from my privileged space of where I am. And I recognize that not everybody lives in a place that is safe, that you feel that your kids can just walk out and go around the street. So I just want to honor too the place that I'm saying this from my own privilege right now. However, there are things that we can still do to allow our kids to, you know, like almost push the edge a little bit and then fail and get up and keep going. I think of my own son. He runs track, and he trains for track, but he doesn't want to run races. He's afraid. And I said, well, why? He's like, well, what if I don't come first? Who says you have to come first? But this is this expectation that if I'm not the best, then I shouldn't try. And I said, you can come last, but you still have to run the race. In fact, there's no question you are running at least two races this year. And he looked at me and you could feel the horror in his heart. And I said, and you're going to feel uncomfortable at the starting line. And when they shoot, you know, when they say go, you're going to, you know, maybe fall on your face. However, you're going to do the next race too. And the most important thing we can do is give kids opportunities to expand themselves a little bit, and then meet them when it's hard, when they fail. It's like, yeah, that was hard. You know, you're not the only one who's fallen on their face in a race. You know, Olympic athletes do this. Okay, let's get up. Let's try again. And my tone is caring and it's loving and there's no judgment and it's that invitation. And then we show our kids the times where we failed. And you should see this time. Like, I was a swimmer. I used to, you know, jump in the pool before the gun all the time went off and I would not be able to race. And I made mistakes. And, well, look, here I am still. I'm still okay. And these are ways that we can show kids. That's how we model compassion too, is by sharing our struggles and how we manage to get through them. And then we give them the opportunity to do that too. So they can build the resilience with that practice of compassion.
Yeah, I love that. Yes, I love it. And self-compassion is what helps you get back up off the floor to stand up. It's like it's the friend coming up and helping you get back up so you can continue going. So it's not the falling that's scary. What we need is the resource to help us get back up once we fall. Totally. Falling is inevitable, but skills to get back up is what we're trying to build with self-compassion.
100%. And we do that together with our kids when it starts. Like, we're there to hold them and pick them up. But we want them eventually to know that they can pick themselves up. Like you said, it's like, I have the internal resources to get myself off that floor when I fall. I have that what's within me to be able to keep going. And self-compassion is a practice. It's how we continue to meet ourselves every time it's hard. It's a mindset. It says, like, yes, this is hard, and I can do hard things, and I'll be okay. And I know how to meet myself with care. It turns down the dial on judgment, criticism, you know, all those ideas of perfectionism, and turns up the dial on love, kindness, care. And our world needs that more so than ever.
Yeah. Oh, so much great conversation. Thank you so much. Could you share just a little bit about where people can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me here. To learn more about the work that I do, my website is lisabailiff.com. I'm sure you'll link it. There's lots of different resources there and different ways of getting to know the work that I've written and the work that I'm putting out in the world. And if you're looking for ways to learn this as a parent, you know, I also work with the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion. We have ongoing courses where you can come and learn about how to sustain this for you first, so then you can go out and share it with your children. So check out the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Lisa. Great having you here
today.
You're
so welcome. My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like additional resources to support you in your parenting journey, my free gift to you is access to my parenting membership with a free 30-day trial where you'll find bite-sized video and audio strategies, scripts, masterclasses, a private community with parents just like you, and weekly group coaching calls directly with me, and so much more. Go to delightinparenting.com/membership to learn more.